The woman in your life will do what she must do to comfort you and calm you down and let you rest now. The woman in your life, she can rest so easily. She knows everything you do because the woman in your life is you.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to Women's Spaces. My name is Elaine B. Holtz, and I'm your host. And with me at the board is my friend, my partner, and technical engineer, Ken Norton. Good morning, Ken.
Good morning.
Wow, it's already the last Monday of the month. Where did November go? Where did December go? Well, you can tell that time is going by so fast. By the way, next week we're not going to be on because it's Christmas holiday and we'll be doing a rerun, but we will be back at the first of the year. Anyway, I have a special guest with me this morning. Joining me on the phone will be Harriet Fraud. Harriet Fraud is a mental health counselor and hypnotherapist in practice in New York City. She is a published author and writes about pressures on families and the economics of the United States of America. Her articles have appeared in numerous publications. Interesting topic. We will be talking about the mental health of our country and how the outcome of this election is affecting us all. I mean, it was really interesting listening to Amy Goodman, what's going on in the country. It's just amazing. Harriet Fraud also just happens to be the wife of Richard Wolf, who does the show Economic Update, which, by the way, we are proud to say is on KBBF every Tuesday from 11 to 12. My partner, of course, and fabulous technical engineer, Ken Norton's father, Donald Lester Norton, passed away at 2:30 a.m. This Sunday, December 18th. Can you believe this? One day after he celebrated his 92nd birthday, he was surrounded by family and friends in Arcadia, California. He was a wonderful man. We didn't see eye to eye politically. He was kind of interesting about that. But we definitely saw eye to eye when it came to loving and caring for one another. I lost my father, Solomon Holtz, who was only 63. So Mr. Norton, and that's what I called him, really lived a good life. And for some reason, I just loved calling him Mr. Norton. I mean, he didn't seem like Dad to me. He just seemed like Mr. Norton. In fact, one time when Ken and I broke up, imagine this, Mr. Norton wrote me a letter and apologized for his son, what a fool he was to give me up. Well, that was very interesting, you know. I mean, it just the thought of him, you know, the man lived to 92 years old, and the fact that he made his transition the day after his 92nd birthday after a huge celebration. I mean, it was just amazing. So rest in peace, Mr. Norton. Rest in peace. You were a good man, and you did a good job. Well, lots of stuff going on in our community. A special shout out to the Santa Rosa City Council. Some tremendous changes. We have a new mayor, Chris Corsi. Congratulations, Chris. He was voted in unanimously. And also, the youngest person on our city council, Jack Tibbett, 26 years old. He has been elected to be the vice mayor. And, you know, Jack Tibbett is an amazing young man. He actually got the most votes in the election. And that was one of the motivations for making him vice mayor, because the public had spoke. They really supported this young man, and I'm really proud of him, and I'm very excited about the fact that Chris Corsi is our mayor. You know, Chris used to write for the Press Democrat, and I used to love his commentaries. Well, very important meeting is coming up tomorrow at the Board of Supervisors, and you can go on the website, Sonoma County Board of Supervisors, I believe it's .com, and you can find out the exact address. I don't know what happened to my notes here, but what's going to be happening tomorrow, the meeting starts usually in the morning at 8:30, but I think this is going to be in the afternoon. They're going to be making the final decisions on the cannabis ordinances here in Sonoma County, so I think it's very important important that people show up and recognize that, you know, recognize that this is very important, that they're going to be making some rules and regulations that regulate our community. And we need to have a voice. We really do. Another thing I'm really excited about, you know, I talked about it last week, but that I wasn't sure because we thought there were one or two marches going on, but that's all been finalized. There's going to be one march, and it's going to be in solidarity with the Women's March in Washington, and that's going to be happening on January 21st. So I just want you folks to mark your calendars, and it's also going to be the day after Inauguration Day. Oh my goodness, I can't. I mean, when I start thinking about these things, I mean, I just kind of, my mind just goes, ooh, you know, it's just a very interesting time right now. And the march is being run by a group of women, and they're calling it Sonoma County Stands Together for Women. And they'll rally on January 21st at noon at Santa Rosa City Hall. And I'm really excited because I'm going to be there, and our president, Alicia Sanchez, I'm proud to announce, is going to be one of the speakers. And I'll tell you something, you don't want to miss hearing a speech from Alicia, because she has a lot to say, a lot of passion, a lot of feeling, and a lot of experience working with women and also working, organizing unions and doing all kinds of wonderful things for the community. In fact, if you go over to the Martin Luther King Park, you can see a picture of Alicia. And there's also a picture of Alicia on the Press Democrat building. I'll never forget when I discovered that. That was just amazing to me, amazing, and she's an amazing woman. Well, I had a wonderful week this week, and I'll tell you, I was blessed to have a tour of the History Museum in Santa Rosa over there on Fifth Street. Folks, it is the best kept secret in the county. There's a woman by the name of Cynthia Hung, and she's the one who runs all the exhibits, and she gave me, this is my second time, I write for the Sonoma County Gazette, Santa Rosa Snippets, and I wanted to put a little article about some of the shows that they're having at the museum, and Cynthia gave me a tour, and it was absolutely wonderful. You don't want to miss what's there. They have two fabulous, fabulous displays. The first display is all about the 60s. I mean, I was amazed to see all the different posters and different way people dressed and some of the music. And I found out, of all things, that Jerry Garcia from the Grateful Dead went to Anley High School in Sebastopol. I mean, that is amazing to me. And, you know, there was a wonderful, wonderful art exhibit by an African-American woman by the name of Faith Reingold. You do not want to miss this exhibit. It is absolutely fabulous. She does masks, and she does all kinds of paintings and storybooks. And what's so interesting about this woman was when she got her first commission, her mother was into textiles, and her and her mother had to ship these big, big paintings to the art museum that they're going to be displayed in. And it was extremely expensive. So they put on their creative hat, and like I said, her mother was in textiles, and what they did was they took her canvases, the paintings, and then they surrounded it with material to make it look like a quilt, and then they were able to fold it up and ship it half price. But when you go into the museum and you see these beautiful displays of the artwork that she did, and the mask, and some of the story, and she writes on the quilts, she has stories. It's an amazing, amazing display. So I really want to encourage people to go down to the museum. Bring your children, especially on that 60s. It brings back such memories. I only have one complaint about the display, and that is, you know, I'm going to drink a little water. I'm getting a little dry here. What's so interesting about the 60s is the 60s was more than drugs and rock and roll. You know, we have to recognize that. It was more than drugs and rock and roll. What the 60s and the early 70s were all about was protesting the Vietnam War. We wanted to stop the war. You had young men burning draft cards. You know, Ken tells this story to me that he was number 300 and something when they pulled the draft cards for men to go into the service, to go over to Vietnam, and how bad he felt because there were his friends were going, and here he was gleefully saying, I am so happy I don't have to go. It was a very volatile time, and it was actually the first time that I can remember that I saw people actually coming out in the streets and protesting war. So when you go and you look at the display of the 60s, of course you see a lot of these psychedelic posters and you see a lot of the paraphernalia and that had to do with drugs, but you have to recognize it was not the whole thing. We were protesting a war, and let me tell you something. It was very, very scary. I'll tell you a little story about myself that was very interesting. I was going to Los Angeles City College. I went back to school in 1970 at the age of 30, and at the age of 31, I became a journalism major. And I went into, and I was very conservative at the time. You know, I'm a first-generation American, and as far as my family was concerned, American could do no wrong, and so I thought the war was fine. I knew there were protests going on, but I was not exactly in agreement with it. And I came into my class, and my editor, Rita Cash, comes up to me and says, Elaine, you've got to go out and you've got to interview these people. They're in the down at the field, the sports field here at Los Angeles City College. It's a group of soldiers. And I said, oh. They're called the Wheelchair Brigade. I said, oh, that sounds interesting. So I went down there, and there were 50 young men, paraplegics, anti-war, telling me the horrific story about what was going on in Vietnam. And guess what, folks? I changed. That was a change for me that I'll never forget. When I walked out after interviewing all 50 of them, can you imagine listening to every story, every war story? I walked out, and I said to myself, we have got to bring an end to war. We have got to stop this war, and we have to stop all wars. It makes no sense, especially when you see young, beautiful men crippled. They'll never walk again. I mean, it was a stunning moment for me. And then about a week later, what was even more interesting is they had the Marine recruiters come on campus, and there was a big to-do about it, and they arrested several of the students. Well, two of the students that were arrested were journalism students, and they were part of they wrote the entertainment column. They weren't even there to cover the story. They were just happened to be walking by when the tables went over, and they were arrested. And when I went down with Rita Cash, my editor, and we read the police report, they put down that they were communists. And I thought, wait a minute, they're not communists. They wrote the entertainment articles. They weren't even in the protest. But I began to analyze it, and I began to realize that everything that happened then, they would say, oh, it's the communist conspiracy, it's the communists, it's the radicals. Well, I decided to write a editorial, and I said I was tired of the communists getting all the credit. I wanted the credit to go to free-thinking young people like myself. We were protesting the war. It was an unjust war, and it was so interesting. Before I knew it, I was down in the president's office with the FBI agent wanting me to explain what I meant, and it was a riveting moment. And then Dr. Kaufman, who was the president at the time, as I was walking out of his office, he said to me, "You better be careful." And I remember thinking to myself, "I'm a journalist. Why do I have to be careful? I'm here to report the news. I'm here to give opinions. I'm here to help people start thinking about what's going on in this world." So it was a very, very interesting time for me, and all that came back. All that came back when I saw the exhibition at the museum on the 60s. So let me tell you the address. It's at 425 7th Street in Santa Rosa. It's right across the street from Macy's and all the mall over there. And if you want to get more information, go to www.museum.com. museumsc.org. So that's www.museumsc.org, and you'll find out all the information. There is a small cost, and I think that children under 12, I think, are admitted free, but it's worth going down and worth seeing it. I mean, I enjoyed it tremendously. Okay, well, we're not going to be here next Monday. So this I consider this the last Monday of December. You know, next Monday or next Sunday, I think, is going to be Christmas. I can't believe it. And then New Year's. And we will be back the first week of January. Well, since it's the last Monday of the month, we're going to do the Women's Spaces Pledge. So why don't we just all sit back and relax? And, you know, this is the last show of 2016, the last live show. And it's been an amazing year for me. I mean, I really appreciate all the support that I've gotten from all my listeners. And I want you to encourage you to become fans on Facebook. You know, I always joke and say, you know, Oprah Winfrey has several million. I have over 400 fans going on 500. And I would appreciate people going on Facebook to Women's Spaces and becoming a fan. And also, when you go on Women's Spaces, if you're interested in finding out who's going to be on the show, I always make an announcement. And there is also a copy of the pledge. And if you go to www.womenspaces.com, you can also see a copy of the pledge. And if you email me at elaine@womenspaces.com, I'll be happy to send you a copy of the pledge. I mean, so there's lots of ways that you can get it. And as I always do at the end of the year, I try to give the little story behind the pledge, you know, just to remind people how it happened and how it came back. I have two grandchildren, Ryan and Caitlin. And when Ryan was about 5 or 6 years old, you know what it's like with his parents running here and there and everywhere. And I used to pick him up from daycare. And one day he got into the car and he started crying. I says, "Ryan, what's the matter?" And he says, "My teacher said I'm a bad boy. I'm a real bad boy." And I looked at him and I says, "You're not a bad boy." I says, "You know, I mean, you're a little boy. I'm sure you did something you weren't supposed to do, but that doesn't make you a bad boy." I says, "You know, your self-esteem should not depend on what that teacher says. Your self-esteem depends on what you feel inside and what your grandma thinks of you." And I said, "You know, what other people say, they can't judge him as being a bad boy." And so every time I picked him up, I used to say this pledge to him. And when he graduated from UC Santa Cruz, he looked me straight in the eye and he said the pledge to me. And that's when I decided that I was going to bring it on to Women's Spaces. And it's kind of like my signature, you know, or, you know, everybody has something to be reminded by. I would like to be identified with this pledge because I think it is so important as women, particularly, that we learn to stand up, that we learn to speak our truth, and that we are not fearful of doing something wrong or what somebody else thinks of us. You know, Terry Cole Whitaker, who was a dear friend of mine, wrote a book called "What You Think of Me Is None of My Business." And it's true. I don't want to know what you think of me. I want to know how you feel about me, maybe, but not, you know, all this other stuff. It doesn't really matter. Besides, you might think one way of me one day and the next day think another way of me. So the most important thing is how you work on yourself and how you feel about yourself. So that's a little background on the pledge. And guess what? I do it all the time. I do it 3 or 4 times before I come on the air because this is kind of, you know, this is nerve-wracking. I'm raw. I'm live. You know, I'm speaking to I don't know who. And, you know, I have to build my self-esteem up. And that's how I do it, through this pledge. So just sit back and relax. If you're in the car, just keep your eye on the road and repeat after me. I'll say one line and then you say another line. And I'm going to ask Ken if he would join me. So here we go with the Women's Spaces pledge. My self-esteem
does not depend
on anything
outside of me.
My self-esteem
depends
on
my relationship
with myself
and my higher power.
Wow, that gives me such an oomph. My self-esteem does not depend on anything outside of me. My self-esteem depends on my relationship with myself and my higher power. And you know, for higher power, you can put the great woohoo, you can put Jesus, Muhammad, I don't care who's in there. Whoever you get your spiritual feeling from, or your faith or whatever it is, that's what belongs in that line. So just listen to me. I'm going to say it very slowly. Absorb it. Make it your New Year's resolution that you're going to start looking at your own self-esteem, and you're going to recognize it doesn't depend on anything outside of you. So let's just listen to it and just absorb it. My self-esteem does not depend on anything outside of me. My self-esteem depends on my relationship with myself and my higher power. Wow, what an empowering statement. Well, you know, lots to think about. That's what Women's Spaces is about. I hope you've thought a lot with me over the last year. Well, I want to give you another reminder. Christmas is next week. The show, we will be doing a rerun. And Ken is going into surgery tomorrow morning, so I would like all my listeners to please put him in my in their prayers and thoughts. You know, we know it's going to be a simple procedure, but it's always good when we have that prayer power out there. And also, we are going to be taking a break, so next week is going to be a rerun. We haven't decided yet when, what, you know, who we're going to be putting on. And then next, we will be back in 2017. And you know what's so interesting about 2017? I can't believe it. It's going to be my 77th year on this planet. I mean, being 77, that's 3 years from 80. Can you imagine if I'm still on the air at 80? That'll be very, very interesting. Well, a reminder, the National Organization for Women meets this Wednesday, 12:30 p.m. at the Roundtable Pizza over here on Guerneville Road. And it's important, again, to mark your calendars for January 22nd. We will be there. The National Organization for Women will be there. I will be there. We're hopefully going to have a table. And like I said, our president here at KBBF, Alicia Sanchez, is going to be one of the main speakers. And I'm really, really excited about that. Well, we're going to take a musical break right now. And what, you know, when I first came on to Women's Spaces in 1976 or 1977, I'm not sure, is when all the women's music started coming out. And I remember when I first played this song, I got so much feedback from the community. It was amazing. And it's a song by Holly Near called No More Genocide. And I wonder, when will it stop? I mean, here I am. I was doing this in 76, so 76, 86, 96, 20. That's 40 years, and we're still warring. I mean, my God, you think we'd get tired of killing each other, don't you? I mean, it's just kind of interesting. Anyway, so we're going to be listening to Holly Near singing No More Genocide. And when we return, I will be talking with Harriet Fraud, who is a mental health counselor and hypnotherapist in practice in New York City. And she's going to be talking about the mental health of our country. And also to remind you that Harriet Fraud is the wife of economist Richard Wolf, who has a show here on KBBF every Tuesday morning from 11 to 12. So now let's hear Holly Near and No More Genocide, and then when we come back, we'll be talking with Harriet Fraud.
Why are our history books so full of lies? When no word is spoken of why the Indians died, or that the Chicanos loved the California land, do our books all say it was discovered by one white man? Well, that's just a lie, one of the many, and we've had plenty. I don't want more of the same. No more genocide in my name. Nazi forces grow again. Ignorance gives them a place. The Klan is teaching children to hate the human race. Where once there was a playground, now an MX missile plan. They think it's fun to see just how much we can stand. Cape Town and Beirut, San Salvador, Greensboro, Belfast, Manila, and many more. It's a crime. Do we think the fascist right will save the world in time? They try to tell us all, but we've got to tell them no. Tell them that it's a
What a powerful song, No More Genocide in Our Name. And I think of some of the films I've seen about Syria and what's happening in Iraq. And, oh, my God, when is it going to end? You know, that song was written and performed for the first time around 1974, 1975. You know, you just start thinking about it. I mean, when is it going to end? Well, for you just joining us, you are listening to KBBF 89.1 FM Calistoga, Santa Rosa. I want to remind my listeners the opinions expressed here are not necessarily the opinions of KBBF, its board of directors, members, and Women's Spaces. Well, welcome back. You're listening to Women's Spaces, and I'm your host, Elaine B. Holtz. And without further ado, I want to introduce my guest on the phone with me, Harriet Fraud. Welcome, Harriet. Welcome once again to Women's Spaces.
Thank you so much, and I am glad to be here.
Well, before we begin, I'd like to tell my listeners a little bit about you. Is that okay, Harriet?
Yes.
Well, Dr. Harriet Fraud is a psychotherapist and a hypnotherapist in private practice in New York City. She is a founding member of the feminist movement and the journal Rethinking Marxism. For 40 years, she's been, I love this, a radical committed to transforming U.S. personal and political life. She writes regularly for Truth Out and journals such as Tucan and the Journal of Psychohistory. Her latest book, written with her husband Richard Wolff and Stephen Resnick, is Class Struggle on the Home Front. She writes a blog called Economy and Society with Richard Wolff, which appears on her website, Harriet, HarrietFraad.com. And the website of Richard Wolff is rdwolff.com. Her newest publication is an essay written with Tess Fraud Wolff, that's her daughter, Imagine Personal and Sexual Life Under Socialism. Wow, it sounds exciting, Harriet. Imagine Personal and Sexual Life Under Socialism, which appears in the forthcoming book, Imagine Socialism in the USA, which was put out. Go ahead.
It's already out, the book.
Oh, the book's already out. Okay, so yeah. It's out, folks, so you can get it. Can you get it on Amazon or any of those places?
Sure can.
Well, it sounds like a very, very exciting book. And also another thing that is very important to mention about Harriet Fraud is she is the wife of Richard Wolff, the economist, and he does have a show here on KBBF every Tuesday at 11 o'clock to 12 p.m. And also what's very interesting and very important to note is that Harriet has become a regular, and I think you're going to be on every other show, Harriet.
No, the first show of every month.
Okay, the first show of every month, and you just don't want to miss it. And today we're going to be talking. I had Harriet on about 2 weeks ago, but we just ran out of time, and I wanted to give her a little bit more space on this very important topic. We're going to talk about the mental health of the United States. And I'll tell you something, when you go around looking at some of the issues that are going on and some of the frustrations that even in the progressive community that are happening, you have to question. So let's start, Harriet. Let me ask you a question. Is there anything else you'd like to add? And also, why mental health? Why do you think that's important to look at the mental health of a country?
Well, what I'd like to add is that my work is primarily now available at Democracy at Work or on rdwolff.com. But in any case, why we have to look at mental health? Well, we have to look at mental health because whether people are feeling hopeful and connected or not has to do with all sorts of issues. It has to do with opiate addiction, which is the biggest cause of accidental death now in the United States. It has to do with all sorts of other addictions. It has to do with the murder rate. It has to do with people, whether people are in jail or not. It has to do with family connection. It has to do with mental health drug prescriptions. Well, that has to do with profit as well. But it has to do with weight disorders and every other kind of disorders, because psychological disorders are not only maintained and produced mentally, but also by a social climate. The violence level in the United States, the murder rate, all of those things have to do with mental health issues. And so we can't really look at anything, whether it's the incarceration rate, or at least at many things, any social and personal phenomenon, or eating disorders, or murder, or crimes, or sexual abuse, or family disintegration, without looking at what's going on with people's mental health and why. Those are all things that are greatly influenced by a nation's mental health.
What do you think? What do you think is? What do you think is creating some of the? I mean, when every time you turn on the radio or you look at the papers, someone's shot up a family or something has happened. I mean, it's become almost epidemic.
Well, part of the part of what's happening is that the basic war program of the United States. The United States is the most militaristic, the biggest military power. It's the biggest seller of arms around the world, which contributes to the carnage around the world. And it's the last empire that's starting to expand wherever it can. We have seven countries that we're bombing at the moment. And that level of $1 trillion going towards killing people is, it influences everyone. The preoccupation with war, the nation as a war machine, that has a huge influence on the violence level. Also, the fact that instead of saying, buy guns, make a profit for gun dealers, the gun dealers have decided with the NRA to say that buy guns, protect your manhood and the Second Amendment, means that we have a level of mass shootings that's completely out of kilter with the rest of the world. So, for example, the last month that I really studied it was September, and the United States had 40 mass shootings in September. Now, a mass shooting is not a political shooting or a personal shooting where a man wipes out his family, which happens very often, or a woman kills her lover or vice versa. A mass shooting is where someone is so enraged and mentally disintegrated that they fire into a group of people that they don't even know, at a mall, at a nightclub, wherever it is. The United States had 40 of those, and where at least four people are shot.
40
in the month of September.
You know, that there's hardly any news about it.
Well, it's not even big news anymore unless you've shot 25 people or more, because it's everywhere. I happen to follow it, and so I look and see. But among the advanced, developed countries, the next in line for mass shootings is Germany, which had four mass shootings in the last 4 years. We had 40 in the month of September. So we're talking about a level of violence that's completely out of proportion. There is a proliferation of guns in the United States, but then again, Canada has a lot of guns because they have a lot of hunting, but they don't have a lot of mass shootings. The same thing is true of Switzerland, where everybody, you know, males are in the army and they have a gun that they have hidden away somewhere, but they don't shoot each other. That, you know, there are other countries that have guns, but the level of thinking that you can solve your problems or get rid of your anger by just killing, shooting, is something that is American. There are no other film. There's the film industry has more violence than anybody else's film industry. I've been to the toy shops all around Europe. There are no guns in the toy shops for kids. That's just not part of their play. You see them in the playground, and occasionally they're going to pretend they're cops and robbers, and they're shooting each other with their finger. But they don't have little kids' submachine guns and assault weapons and cap guns of every kind. There's a level at which people think that violence will recoup their dignity.
That's an interesting point, that violence will recoup their dignity. And I'm also thinking about these assault, you know, these guns, these toy guns that they have are just incredible to me. And sometimes I think to myself, it's not necessarily the culture, but why aren't parents, what stops parents from making better decisions, or why do they allow this to happen? Do you think that's part of what's going on, that they're so influenced by the media and some of the things that are happening, that they actually are encouraging that in their kids? I mean, what do you think is happening there?
They're encouraging it because, look, the United States is an empire that, although we are not succeeding in our latest imperialistic ventures, whether in Afghanistan or Iraq or Syria or Yemen, we are still bombing people and sending drones and bombs to Pakistan. And, you know, we really, they see in the paper that the United States is a shooting country. I mean, I live in New York City. The buses have many ads for films, and many of them are a man looking down the barrel of a gun and saying how he's going to get even. And you don't have that to this extent elsewhere. What I like to imagine, which would really change the message for Americans, is if every time you see a guy with a gun, if instead you saw a guy with a vacuum cleaner, how would it change the national image? But there is a general lauding of American military power all over this country. And certainly that is where most of, that's the biggest expenditure of their tax money. And also, it's an enormous employer, because as the recession deprives people of jobs, particularly people who don't have a college degree, there's an economic draft, and people sign up for the military. It's particularly true in the southern United States, where there are billboards for all the military departments that are everywhere.
Well, you know, as you're talking, one of the things that keeps coming into my mind is that people feel powerless. They feel powerless, and in their powerlessness, they feel if they're looking at a movie, say for example, and all of a sudden I'm just creating a scenario in my mind. You had a fight with your boss, or you got fired from your job, and then you go into a movie theater. You know, you're trying to get some relief. Instead of seeing a comedy, you see this film that talked about the boss, and the guy goes into the office and kills him. And then all of a sudden a light bulb goes out. Do you think that contributes in that way, in that fashion? That is giving people ideas?
Giving people ideas, an idea that you can recoup your manhood. I studied each of the mass murderers in September, and what all of them have in common is they're all male. Sometimes a woman will accompany her guy, but every single one of them had either just lost a job, which is a token of manhood in the society, or just lost a relationship with a woman or another man, which is a token of manhood in the society, and often both together. And the idea is, don't get mad, get even. Shoot them.
Don't get mad, get even. And, you know, when you're talking about, you know, I just had this vision. I remember, I think it was Rubio. Was it Rubio that said something about Donald Trump's hands? And here's,
yes.
You know, here he is, a nominee for the President of the United States, and he has to go up and has to defend his hands. And I thought to myself, I says, is that what's happening to our males? Is that they feel so powerless? And I'm wondering if that has a lot to do with their domination or wanting to dominate women's bodies.
Well, it certainly does. That's the only crime that's going up in most cities, rape. Where you assert your manhood forcibly as your sexual manhood over a woman. That what has happened is, ever since 2008, when millions of jobs were either outsourced, well, this started actually in the late 70s, where millions of jobs were outsourced overseas, mechanized, robotized, or computerized, and the overwhelming number were male jobs, jobs in factories, jobs in machinery, jobs in high power sales, whereas the women's jobs, which are mainly poorer paid social service jobs, were not outsourced as readily or as handily, and so that many, many more males lost the union jobs that gave them the ability to support dependent wives and children.
Well, you know, when you talk about that, I have to go back to my own family when I grew up. You know, Ken and I, my partner and I, talk about this quite a bit, that we come from families. You know, I was born in the 40s, he was born in 48, and so the families, my family, his father was educated through the military, my father was a union man, so we were really in the middle class. I mean, I remember my mother was so excited when she could go out and buy me 2 cashmere sweaters, that we actually had that kind of prosperity coming from the Depression like they did. So,
right.
As you're talking, I can't help but go back to this article that you and your daughter wrote, and I'm wondering if that's what you're talking about. Imagine personal and sexual life under socialism, that somehow, if we have the appropriate social programs, if we have all our ducks in order, is that our sexual lives, our feeling lives improve?
Of course they do. Look, sexual relationships between men and women in Norway, Sweden, and Denmark are not what they are here. The divorce rate is not what it is here. And partly, that's because single women get 98% of what men earn, and mothers are high earners and get time off. Fathers get paternity leaves Every men's bathroom has a changing table, and men are very much encouraged to be carers of children. Now, they don't have these huge militaries, those countries, and they spend their money on social programs, supporting people and supporting families, and so that there's a gentleness in that society, in all of those societies that we don't have, because people feel better. They're taken care of. And I think what happened is the mass of American men who did not have college education, particularly, but those with college are now in outrageous debt, the highest rate of debt in the United States, even bigger than mortgage and credit card debt. But those people without a high school degree, as long as they were white and as long as they were male, they could support dependent wives and children and make a middle-class life. That's over. Trump would like to blame it on immigrants, minorities, and women because those people were given some rights at the same time as the jobs were exported. However, it was the export of the jobs by the corporate elite that knocked men out of their jobs and out of the manhood definition that comes with I am a man because I have a dependent wife, because I support my family. And now what has happened is for working class males without job security, marriage is over. You know, 40% of American kids overall are born outside of a marriage. Women don't want to support men who have ideas that women should do all the housework, but are also not providing the income to keep the woman at home doing that housework. Now, I don't believe in those sex roles. I think it could have been very liberating for both men and women to work outside the home and inside the home and get supported by the government in child care centers, high quality child care centers and after school programs and summer programs and so on, and vacation time, which the United States, by the way, has the least vacation time of any advanced industrialized nation.
Well, you know, when you talk about that, what's so interesting, my mind goes right back to the latest military budget, which I think is $619 billion, not million, yes, but billion.
And I think that's the active one. There's a lot more spent for other military-related things.
But what do you think it is? You know, it's interesting when you talk about these things, and I'm thinking about populations, and people will vote for somebody who's claiming that he's going to get rid of Social Security or Medicare, or vote for somebody who is some of the, you know, I think they're going to put somebody into the Labor Department, the head of the Labor Department, that believes that people should only earn $9 an hour. That should be the cap. You know, why do people vote for people like this? It's against their own interest. Is that part of that violence? I mean, what is going on in their psyche that creates where they don't even vote for their own interests?
Well, I think what went on in their own psyche is that they felt enraged. They feel enraged. They've been robbed. The American dream is over. Their marriages are over. Their status as white males is over. Their jobs that they could count on are over. And Hillary Clinton represents the neoliberal elite. You know, liberal in that she did believe in some social benefits. She believed, although she supported a $12, not a $15 minimum wage, she did believe in abortion rights, Planned Parenthood's validity, things like that. But she was not speaking to them. They were in the basket of deplorables. And they felt her contempt. These are people who, when they go, when they interact with professionals who they consider elite, whether it's a teacher at their school or the doctor or a lawyer, they feel that they are looked down on and considered inferior. And that's true in many cases. These are very angry people, and they are attracted to an angry candidate, and they're not looking closely at what he's doing. They'll get a rude shock. But these are the people who voted, who wanted to support Bernie Sanders, because he also was angry, and he was angry at the people at the top. But the people at the top made sure, and Hillary Clinton made sure, to block his nomination and made an honorary chair out of Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who blocked Bernie and denied him money and access to the Democratic Party, which he was running on. And so they feel very angry at Hillary's elitist attitude. They feel angry at the fact that she brought in $15 million in the past year, when there's only 3% of women in this whole country who make $150,000 a year that could support a middle-class lifestyle. And Trump captured their rage, and they don't care. Just like British people voted against Brexit because the establishment wanted it. They don't know what Brexit meant, and they don't care. They're screaming no. And Donald Trump is not an ordinary politician. He doesn't obey the rules. He screams and yells and pretended he was a populist, even though he is not one. And he was the only candidate that captured their rage. I think they'll jump right out of the frying pan into the fire with Donald Trump. But I can see, and I have clients who voted for him. One in particular is a plasterer. And he said he loves the rage because he feels completely shafted by the system.
Well, it's true. I mean, when you start thinking about it, when you start looking at what's happening, especially with jobs and this TPP and what's happening at Standing Rock, I mean, all these different situations that come in front of people, and at the same time, you feel so powerless. So maybe what you're saying is that when they go to the ballot and they can identify with this anger and they can stamp that candidate's name, it gives them a feeling of, I have some relief, I have a friend, I've done something.
Yeah, and he's angry too. And I'm saying no, just like he does. No to the elites and no to the status quo.
But meanwhile, he's put every elite you can imagine.
Exactly. Absolutely. Goldman Sachs has won all of our last five elections. There are four Goldman Sachs people in his economic advisory council, but what he said is not what he's doing.
I feel so, you know, I have to say this, Harriet, I cannot help but have compassion for all these people.
Of course.
I mean, it is, you know, it is the saddest situation because to me the solution is so simple. It's getting there that's so complex. Well, I want to go into a little bit is about how is this affecting women? How are women, you know, I'm watching women. I mean, you see the Sarah Palin's to a woman like yourself. You see all the different, you know, the different people, the different women that are coming forward. And you just go, wow, you know, what is happening to women? And what is your thought as far as a new women's movement happening, which I think is very important here? I know they're going to be having in January 21st, they're going to be having a 1 million march for women in Washington, D.C., and all across the country, there's going to be supportive actions. What do you think is happening to women, and what do you think their role is right now? Well, especially in helping with the mental, like you're saying, that we're kind of, I'll use it very blankly, we're kind of going nuts in our country.
Well, the thing is that men are going nuts. And although an awful lot of women voted for Trump because they felt Hillary's contempt for working class women. But women have not suffered the way men did. First of all, our jobs were not cut on the same level. They were lower paid social service jobs. The biggest new job categories that are growing in the United States are food service workers, which are overwhelmingly women, and the lower medical trades like x-ray technician, blood technician, and so on. Those are usually women's jobs that are less, nurse's aide, home health aide. Those are women's jobs. They're poorly paid relative to men's, but they're harder to outsource. It's the it's production machinery that was outsourced, not social services. Also, within the stereotyped sex roles with which Americans grow up, women are the ones in charge of relationships. Women are the ones who invite people over. Women are the ones who nurture children. Women are the ones who keep in touch with relatives. For many, many women, if not most, their primary emotional tie, not sexual tie, but emotional tie, is to their best friend, to another woman. And when they have a divorce, they're still connected to their friends, and women's friends have an emotionality that most male friends don't come anywhere near. They're still connected to their children. After a divorce, half of men don't even see their children after 5 years. They see their relatives. They're connected. Women connect with other people as a support. Men's primary connection emotionally has been with their sex partners, with whom they can be vulnerable. So when a woman refuses to marry a man And for the first time in our history, the overwhelming majority of people between 18 and 34 are not married. When a woman refuses to marry a man or divorces him, and most divorces are initiated by women now, the man loses his emotional life. He loses often his connection to his children. He loses his connection to his woman. He loses his connection to the relatives that she used to invite over, to the friends she used to invite over. The kind of emotional bonds that we have been responsible for, and which I'm so glad we have, that connectedness keeps us a whole lot saner. And so we aren't going around killing people. Not that women are generally in great shape, but not like that. Not in violent disintegration as human beings, because the most important aspect of mental health is the ability to make connections with other people. What I like to talk about is that mental health is like a table that has four legs, each of which is very important, or it wobbles.
Harriet, we're coming to the end of our segment, and I have to say one other thing. I'm going to have you on again.
Okay.
Is that okay? No, I want to talk about those four legs. We've laid the groundwork to come into that.
Okay.
And so if that is okay with you, we're coming to the end of our segment. And any last things, like if you could just give an idea of maybe one thought of how a person can just turn this around for themselves.
Well, the way it can is to get connected. To get connected with people who share something with you. Either worry about what life is going to be like on a big political level, on a little one, at a PTA or other meeting. But to connect, people need to connect around common concerns. Without that, we're lost. And one of the things Trump offered angry white people, and particularly white males, is a chance to connect around their rage.
So connection is the seed. Well, Harriet Fraud, we're coming to the end of our segment, and I want to thank you. I mean, I can't believe I left as much time as I possibly could, and there's still so much more that we need to cover. I mean, I'm so enamored by those four legs. So can you give our listeners your website and how they can get a hold of you?
Well, they can get a hold of me best at Democracy at Work, or if they want to ask me something personally, they can go to my email, hfraad@aol.com. That's hfraad@aol.com, and they could connect with me.
Well, I want to thank
you. Say something in the subject matter so I know it's not spam.
And okay? also we will post your website on our website so people can email you.
My website is down right now, so do the Democracy at Work or rdwolf.com. It's better. It has my stuff on it, but it's working.
Okay, I'm going to email you, and I'm going to get you all that. I'll get all that information. But I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart, Harriet Fraud, for being on Women's Spaces again, and I look forward to our next conversation because it's very, very important, and it's such an honor to have you. And I want to thank you, and I want to wish you and your family a joyous holiday season and blessings to all of you, and hopefully one day we will achieve that wonderful goal and have peace on earth and goodwill to all.
And that is the hope, and that's what we need to do with our time.
Thank you so much, my love.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for our show. Special thank you to Dr. Harriet Fraud, who's a psychotherapist and hypnotherapist in private practice in New York. She's a founding member of the feminist movement and just a wonderful, wonderful spirit. And like I said, she is the wife of Richard Wolf, and he's on KBBF every Tuesday from 11 to 12. I also want to wish everyone a joyous holiday season. It's a time of gift giving. And I want to remind people that the world, according to Elaine, is the greatest gift you can give someone. Is a listening ear and a big hug. It may not solve issues at hand, but it makes one feel good and appreciated. A reminder, tell your friends, Women's Spaces will be aired again at 11 p.m. this evening. I'm so excited I get to listen to my own program. I will not be live next week, and I will be back with my first interview of the year. As you know, I've been elected the president for the Sonoma County chapter of the National Organization for Women, and I will be talking with Geraldine Stapleton, who is the president of California now, and I'm really looking forward to that. You know, this has been a good year for Women's Spaces. I want to thank you all out there for listening and supporting the program. And I want to wish you a happy and joyous new year. Wow, when I come back, it'll be 2017. Also, I'm available for speaking engagements. If you have any announcements you'd like to make on the air, you know, about a birthday or something like that, please email me at elaine@womenspaces.com. Remember, our children are the future, and we must never lose sight of that. This is Elaine B. Holtz, and you've been listening to Women's Spaces. Thank you so much for listening, and I look forward to being with you the next time.
And a woman in your life.